be blue, 'cause I can't see you. Richie, I love you.
Hello, this is Rich Wexler of Vintage Annals Archive, Visionaries, and Outsiders podcast. Very, very excited, super excited to talk about episode 90, which is about the documentary Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill. If you know Judy Sill, you know she's amazing. If you don't, you'll learn more about her. I would tell you to go see the documentary. It's playing in some theaters, but it's also going to be on Apple TV and I think Google, Amazon, on the 12th, which is should be coming out today. I'm recording this on the 11th, but it comes out on the 12th. And I got to say, it's been one of the most effective documentaries, one of the most beautiful ones. It's probably it's in my top two or three of musicians, and it's in probably my top 10. It's just something about how they made this. It was very thoughtful. It took them 9 years, and they're just honoring her. And also, there's something in how they used her art and animation and recordings of her being interviewed that just made you feel like you know her. And you know, the more I learn about her, the more I get her. And that's Judy Sill. The more you listen to her, the more you understand her life, the more you really appreciate her music. So I don't know if it's better for you to listen to this and then watch a documentary or vice versa, but this is an amazing documentary. It features Jackson Browne, David Crosby, Linda Ronstadt, David Geffen, Fleet Foxes, Wiseblood, Sean Colvin, J.D. Souther, Big Thief. It's really, really great. Highly recommend it. And I talked to Brian Lindstrom and Annie Brown, who both directed this together, and just really sweet guys. And you could just tell how much they cared about what they were doing, and it will definitely show when you see this documentary. So go check it out right now, today. Get it. Thank you. Yeah, I've been a big fan of Judy for at least 10 years, if not longer. And then I found out about the documentary, and then I wound up talking to Pat Thomas, but we got more into like the albums that he helped. I think it was the second one that he helped put together.
It was the third. It was the posthumous third album called Dreams Come True.
Okay.
Rich, I'm glad you mentioned Pat Thomas. He's just been a huge part of this project, and we're so grateful for, like, especially for the booklet he made and Pat Roques for Dreams Come True, because we used that as a template for our first round of interviews.
I'm curious. I know he handled most of the music, but I know in doing some research for this interview, there wasn't a ton of information out there about it. There wasn't a ton of images. There wasn't a ton of, you know, archival stuff. Did you kind of find more of that in searching as you started, or was that kind of always a bit tricky in terms of getting source material?
Yeah, I mean, we were aware very, very early on that we didn't have, you know, the usual things that most people making a documentary about a musician have, you know, film interviews or, you know, a lot of audio of the person talking about their life. And we just kind of trusted that somehow we'd figure out a way to tell Judy's story in a kind of first person way that could really help the audience understand who she was. And very luckily, about 4 years into the project, we were able to track down a 1972 interview that the wonderful journalist Chris Van Ness, now the late Chris Van Ness, recorded with Judy for the LA Free Press. And it really served as like an oral history of her life up to that point. And that became the kind of narrative spine of the film. And it allowed us to really have Judy narrate her life story.
I thought that was really strong. I mean, I watched it 3 times just to fully prepare.
Oh, wow.
And the first time was the most intensive, I guess. And I felt, I don't know, whatever you guys did, I felt like I knew her when it was over. I felt like I knew her. I don't know if this is purposeful, but it seemed like, I mean, again, that narration, I think, really sold it, is you felt like she was telling you her story and you felt like you knew her a little bit. And then it seemed like, I don't know if this is a choice or not, that you told a little story, played a song, and it was as if Now through the music, I knew her better and I knew her music better. Was that a purposeful choice or was that kind of just how it played out?
I think one of the ways that if we did achieve that effect, it's not just through the first person voiceover, but in fact the animation in the film is inspired by her drawings, the aesthetic of her drawing style. So the idea was to make it as if she were animating the film herself. And then we also used the multi-tracks from Heart Food and Dreams Come True, the posthumous album. So she's scoring the film. So perhaps it has that, or hopefully has this, you know, subtle effect of making it feel like it was in her voice. I mean, that absolutely was our goal. And I'm happy if it had that effect on you, that's terrific.
And notice the last frame of the documentary was the Star of David, the Kabbalah version, I guess. And I love that when I looked about that it meant that's a protector. I mean, God is protector. And I just thought that played in so well with all the themes. I'm just curious on how you all found Judy's music, how you just, you know, it's apparently 6-9 years. I'm so glad this exists because to me, her story is great. But I'm just wondering how kind of what brought you to her and what brought you to the documentary, and then if you could kind of dig a little deeper, how did you get, what made you keep going with this that it took that long and you kept going? Because again, this is definitely one of my favorite documentaries in the past 5 or 10 years.
Oh,
it was just
so
well, wow. So well, it was just the fact that I felt like I knew her and that's not a thing that many documentaries can get across. And it was very strong.
You just made my day, but I'll start and say that I heard about her first through an interview I had read from Andy Partridge of XTC, the band XTC. And that was probably around 2000. And he talked about the tremendous influence she had on his songwriting. I didn't know who she was. Checked her out maybe on Napster. And then when YouTube started, not long after that, that video of her performing the Kiss on the Old Grey Whistle Test appeared. And I remembered, you know, that interview with Andy Partridge, and I checked it out and it just absolutely slayed me. And the first chance I had to show it to Brian, maybe a year or so later, I showed it to him. It had the same effect on him. And then maybe cut to a couple years after that, Brian, do you want to pick up?
I was literally the last day of working on my film Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassis, when a friend, Michael Howells, the architect, said to me, hey, you know who you should make a film about next? I was like, no, who? And he said, Judy Sill. And I didn't even know Michael knew Judy Sill, and that really kind of struck me. And Andy and I started to talk about the possibility of just doing that. And the first task we had to do was make sure that no one else was already making a film about Judy. And once we kind of ascertained that we were, you know, the first, we really dove into it. And what was so fascinating was, like, the more we found out about her personal life, which at first glance seems so at odds with the kind of, you know, ethereal, spiritual depth of her music, the more we were just intrigued by who is this person, and we have to find out more. And that really just led us on, you know, the journey that just ended, you know, or is ending recently. And one thing I'd like to ask Rich is, how did you know about Judy's music?
It's a good question. I think just through searching, like, that whole, I don't know what to call them. I kind of put them in like private press, outsider a little bit. There's something in her voice, and I do a lot of like searching and archiving into similar music. I don't know if you know who Ruth Ann Friedman is. People of that time that just were not famous but could have been, but had the most amazing voices. And I'm not sure where I found her, but I've always loved her. And I did a podcast series and a show called Minx, and they used her music, and I just think I heard about her years ago, and that kind of rebrought it. Finally, I bought the albums that were existing on, you know, in vinyl. I've just really loved her. And then the more I've learned about her, the story, I just kept going.
Like Judy Souther says in the film, people who like Judy Sill really like Judy Sill.
The one thing I understood, especially with noticing the kind of pattern in documentary, as you heard more and you heard more music, it made more sense. And it seemed like some of the people you had on there to talk about her suggests that the more you listen to her, the more you understand her. What are your thoughts on that, on the kind of more you know, it's almost like you a favorite film you watch and you can watch it 15, 20 times, and then every time you watch it something else, you're like, oh wow, like did you find that in searching more about her life and her music?
I certainly know that Judy's music rewards repeated listening. You know, I mean, every time I hear something new, I mean, just the kind of depth and breadth of her arrangements and how she just like fits it all together is, you know, like Tim Page says in the film, a perfect clockwork. And that's really what it's like. And yet it's not, you know, austere or mathematical. It's heartfelt and vibrant and living. I mean, it's just, I can't say enough about it.
Well, also, I would say that, you know, the more we dug into her life, the more it her music and her mission, let's say, her musical mission made sense to us. It was sort of one and the same. You know, she was on a mission, she believed, to help heal people through her music. And so her own life, you know, she was a genuine messenger for that because of the trauma she experienced in her own life. So the more we dug into what she went through and where she came from, and then understood the depths of her musical abilities as well, and you know, just her ability to synthesize everything she learned really quickly and then incorporate that into her work.
I'm curious on how much and where you kind of learned about her connection with I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Pythagorean music theory, as well as it seemed like she was tied to I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Rosicrucian. And those
Rosicrucianism.
two pieces seem to really make up who she was, and I'm just curious on, I guess, on how what you found out about, but also in her own life, how did those things come in, or where did they come in?
Well, she was always on a spiritual quest, I think somewhat to heal her psychic pain, but also because she really believed that she was channeling a sort of perfection. That's that her love of Pythagoras had to do with how the perfection of his musical theory, the music of the spheres, was a representation of the perfection of God. And to her, it was one and the same. So she, it's not a surprise that she saw what she was attempting to create and channel as coming from some higher source. And that, but it was also combined with her need to heal herself in some way and believe that she was in touch with that higher source as well. So when you mentioned the Rosicrucianism or the Star of David and all those symbols, they're all things that are found in her journals. She tried on many different religious hats, including Rosicrucianism, Buddhism. She proclaimed herself a Muslim briefly at one point. So I don't mean to make light of it, but it was sincere and genuine on her part for sure.
If there was a way for, you know, say she was somehow aware of what's going on, do you think she would finally see success, especially in this documentary and in what's happened to her music in the last, you know, 40, 50 years?
Definitely. You know, I think she would, I think she'd be smiling.
Yeah, she'd be delighted, and I think she's more well known now than she was in her lifetime because people can actually find her more easily now than they could in her lifetime.
And it might be that the very things that prevented her from having that bigger audience while she was alive are the exact same things that are making her music survive and be discovered now. That kind of timeless spiritual quality that, you know, I think we all respond to.
You don't have to be a spiritual person, or you could think of music as your religion and respond to her work in this on a spiritual level. That's how I do.
And also, you know, imagine how high the stakes were for Judy. You know, if you feel like you're really on this earth because of a mission to save people through music, because you know that music has saved you, and then when the music doesn't quite have, you know, the response that you hope for, it's like a double rejection.
I liked how you made sure to include her talking about like high vibration, low vibration, or just this idea that any kind of chump off the street who had a bad time could also get to a higher level, and it seemed like that was the impetus for a lot of her music and herself kind of reaching higher and other, you know, people listening to it. And I just thought that was really interesting in terms of you know, just like politically, it's very much about it, like takes class away. It's like there's, you know, whoever is, I don't know. And there's one thing that she talked about that I've heard discussed different ways is that your experiences and how bad things have been, how dark, how, you know, how much darkness you have experienced is also on the other side is equal to the capacity for joy. And I love that she kind of said that in different ways. How did you find, you know, how did you find that in terms of learning about her? What were some maybe examples or?
I'm so glad you brought that up. One of her favorite quotes, one of my favorite quotes of hers is, the lower down you go to get your momentum from, the higher up it will propel you.
Right.
And I think she's such a great example of that.
You know, if you look at her performance of the kiss on the Old Gray Whistle Test, and she just seems to be containing the pain of the world, holding it on her shoulders, and yet she's singing this beautiful song. And so in effect, she's actually trying to channel the pain that she went through in her life and that she's trying to heal people from. And she's showing us that she contains that and is a genuine messenger of it, and then is creating this beautiful song, this beautiful music that she's sort of delivering us from that. That's how I took it. I mean, I just felt that it was, you look at her and you think of this is perseverance through suffering, you know, and it's inspirational. And I think that's really why a lot of people respond to her, that's the effect she was going for, I think also.
Yeah, she's inducing God to give us a break. And as she wrote in her journal, I face the flames to spare you.
How much of the journals, I mean, how much content was in the journal? Was it one journal? Was it a few journals? How much content did you get? Did you glean from the journals?
They were two. So basically what happened is that first tape we found of Judy, the Chris Van Ness interview, took us, you know, her oral history to 1972, from birth to 72. And the journals, there were two of them, and they covered 73 to 79. So we were able to piece together a voiceover from those to finish the story of Judy in her own voice. But it all came from basically two journals, and then an art journal as well, where her drawings were in, and that we use a lot in the film.
Would you consider her a prodigy? I mean, it seems like she was able to, you know, be able to compose, to be able to conduct an orchestra. And it seemed like her ability was more natural. She understood music, but it seemed like she also could understand how to communicate with people to get what she wanted.
She had perfect pitch, for one. She some formal training as a kid on piano, but she could play many, many instruments very well. And she watched her second husband orchestrate, write down the charts for her first album, learned how to do that, and did it all herself for her second album. We have all those charts that you see in the film are all in her hand, where she's charting out the violins and bassoons and oboes, and it's that photo of her conducting the orchestra was from the Hartford sessions. So she taught herself all that between albums one and two. So I mean that maybe is why the genius is in the title of the film.
He earned it. You know, the very few first notes of her song when she was 19, Poor Tender Maiden's Lament, that she wrote while at LA Valley College, and she won the songwriting contest there. It's in the film. And you can just hear, you know, two notes in, you know, it's Judy Sill. I mean, even at 19, she just had a beautiful fingerprint on her stuff that, you know, is just distinctive.
I was just going to say, we could include that story in the film, but that was her first attempt at songwriting, that she entered the songwriting contest at a pretty prestigious music college in Los Angeles, and she won. She won the contest. So, you know, that was an early sign. And it was maybe 5-6 years later when she was kicking heroin in LA County Jail after being busted for forgery, and she'd been doing sex work to support her heroin habit. She said to herself while kicking heroin, if I can do this, I can do anything. And what she really wanted to do is be a singer-songwriter. And 4 years later, she was on the cover of Rolling Stone. So, you know, that takes some talent, I would say, you know?
And there's something in the music that it does hit you. Like I think the people that get it in like 3 seconds. The only other person I feel like does that is Daniel Johnson. I'm not sure if you're fans of him or not, but there's something.
Oh, yes.
When I think about her and I think about him, that there's something in their music that they're able to just, get so raw and honest and real and authentic, and it, within a few seconds or a few lines, just captivate you.
Rich, many of the musician friends that I've made since Brian and I made this film, and who are Judy fans, are also Daniel Dunson fans.
Yeah, it's something in there that I don't, and I think it's more really about the honesty and the purity. I really love that she talks about of things.
Well, she's brutally honest. I mean, in her journals, Judy had a lot of kind of amazing facts to her life that, you know, you look at them and you think, did that really happen? Well, they all really happened. I mean, we read her journals and we couldn't find any instance of her not telling the truth. I mean, she was brutally honest about everything, including herself.
Yeah, there was no instance where, I mean, we went into this thinking, oh, she's making that up. There's a story she told in Rolling Stone magazine about her first husband, which she got an annulment from, who died going over the Kern River Rapids on a rubber raft on LSD. And we just thought that was not true. But then we found the news story, like way into the making of the film. It was too late to include it. But I was like, oh, she was telling the truth about that too, you know? So,
yeah, I don't want to get too many, because I'm not sure if it's problematically legally for you, but it seems like when it comes to Geffen, there's a little bit of unanswered questions in terms of their relationship and kind of the music thing. I'm just curious if there's anything you can talk about in terms of your, you know, finding that information and kind of trying to figure out a way to find a truth within two stories that seem a little bit different.
Sure. Well, first of all, the reason we were able to interview David Geffen was because of Jackson Browne, who took it upon himself after we interviewed him to reach out to David and suggest that he talk to us. And we were very lucky that he did. And basically our approach was really just to kind of give the audience the information and let the audience decide. But I will tell you that I was the one who interviewed David. And after the interview, he came up to me, and you don't really usually see this side of David Geffen in media. But he was very kind of vulnerable. He touched me on the shoulder, looked me in the eye and said, please get my relationship with Judy right, because she meant so much to me. And I think she did. You know, I think he cared about her deeply, as not only as an artist, but also as a person. And I think that comes across in the film.
Definitely. I kept hearing her talk about fast, doing things fast, being fast. Was that a deeper thing? Was that something that was... had a different meaning for her when she talked about fast? Or was, I didn't really quite understand her. Something she would talk a lot about, doing things and making them fast. Like, what was that about in terms of what you found in the journals or in researching her work? And maybe it's just speed of getting it done. I'm not really sure. There was about three or four references where she just talks about getting things done and getting them done fast. And I didn't know if that was...
You mean that she didn't want to rush God? What an outrage when she said that. Like that
part of it.
I mean, I just think that she, it goes to that belief she had that she was channeling this from some higher source, and that it had to be perfect, and that she would be the one to know when it was perfect or not. No one could tell her that, you know.
But there was also times that she talked about wanting things to be fast, and I was just curious on that end, and her being impatient.
Oh, and that it was going to. They're worried that it will. She's going to damage her career because of how impatient she was. Yeah, that's the other side, you know, that she's always balancing these sort of earthly desires with her higher calling, and it was not always easy for her, but she's again was very honest about that struggle.
Well, the mundane part of herself.
She said something about waiting 100 years that she would be bored. It was the problem that she, you know, I don't know, she's talking about after death going somewhere else, and the fact that she would have to wait 100 years and be bored was the big...
That was about dying of an OD, though. That was about her fear of dying of an OD, that's the worst that can happen. If you die of an OD, you'll be in limbo for 100 years, and the worst part of that is you'll be bored, which I guess is kind of what she feared the most. But it also, I think, to Brian and I spoke to the fact that she did not want to die, and that she died of an OD, but that was not suicide, even though everything was ruled suicide in those days. All ODs were in LA County were ruled suicide in those days. But She was writing music to the last few days of her life and was terrified of dying of an OD, but she was an addict. She had a disease and it was more powerful than she was, as it is for many people, unfortunately, you know.
How much in terms of, how much did you all learn about, you know, this dynamic with her of, it seemed like her father dying really kind of threw her off. And I'm just wondering how much of the self-destructiveness, you know, there's something she talks about in a song, and I forget which one, where it's like, you know, even if she, fear of success, it seems like. How much is that just rooted in not being given a lot of attention when she was young, or the loss of her father? I'm just curious on, like, you know, her destructive end, how much of that was maybe inherent, and how much of that was family-based or environment?
The song you're referring to is The Phoenix, and I think the lines are, I was chasing the sun, hoping we will soon be until it turns around to me and I try to run. Which, you know, once again, just that kind of genius ability to, in so few words, communicate so much, right? But yeah, Judy's, the death of her father was a huge, huge loss, and it caused the family to move to LA from Oakland, where her mom very soon remarried the animator Ken Muse, who sexually abused Judy. And that was just a huge, huge trauma for her life. It, you know, rewired her brain and definitely probably made her predisposed even more so to addiction than she might have already been just because of her genes. And what's so interesting was when Andy and I started making the film, at first glance, you know, like robbing liquor stores or whatever, just seems so contrary to her musical gift and her musical subject matter. But actually, it completely makes sense in retrospect, because as she said, like about those robberies, she was just trying to feel something.
I think this idea you just brought up, though, of fear of success, which is not about, oh, what will it be like if I become successful? I'm afraid of that. It's really more about one's internalized self-image of being not deserving of it. And that becomes a sort of character armor that would be threatened if you suddenly got some success, because as counterintuitive as that might seem, that's what she probably believed about herself because of all the things she went through. She must have felt, I think, on some level that she didn't deserve any of this stuff. And that success in some ways freaked her out, because it actually, you know, ran counter to a very negative self-image, but one she was familiar with, that in some, you know, perverse way was comforting, or perhaps, I don't know if that's what you mean, but that kind of makes sense to me too.
Clearly informed her romantic choices.
Oh yes. Good point. Yep.
I like to, you know, there is an inclusion of this kind of odd place of her looking for love, her looking for God or Jesus. And I don't know. I mean, it was very, that it was very well put, it was very well done and very well talked about, and it didn't get kind of odd. What did you know, in terms of that kind of learning about it, I'm just curious more about, if you can expound on that kind of connection, where it was a little bit of love, a little bit of finding God. And it seemed like from the documentary that David was the one that kind of was the trickiest relationship, where she seemed to kind of just fully honor him, and it didn't seem like it was the healthiest for her.
Yeah, David Bearden, right. Well, you know, I think Judy had a lot of challenges, and in a way, a lot of holes to fill, a lot of emptiness to deal with, right? And I think that all of that kind of, you know, burdened her romantic relationships, not only the kind of, you know, spiritual angle, but I would even argue the father angle.
Yeah, and the type of men that she seemed to be attracted to. There's a lot of instances in the journals where she's falling in love one after the other with people who were clearly unavailable, and she did it over and over, looking for some. Her favorite song, one of her favorite songs for sure, was "Someday My Prince Will Come," and she would play that for her friends on the piano all the time. But you know, I think she was looking for a man or love to rescue her, in the same way she was looking at God for that as well. And there wasn't much of a difference between the two quests.
But you know, like a real common thing in recovery is that, you know, during an act of addiction, a person's picker is broken, and they're going to kind of, you know, make choices that usually end in pain. But I just want to point out how Judy also had a very healing power within her, even during all of that. And look at the kind of family of love she surrounded herself with, many of whom were former lovers. JD, Tommy Pelletier, so many people.
Close friends, yeah, yeah.
She really, and not only was she a great friend, but, you know, she was the one who remembered people's birthdays, who always had people come over for holidays. You know, she was a very giving, loving person. And one thing that kind of just like gives me a lot of kind of retroactive joy and appreciation is the family of love that she created. You know, the friends that she found who were just a deep, beautiful part of her life.
Well, it seems like she talks about happiness as attention, whether it's her music, whether it's her friends, you know, lovers. And I don't know, I like that she talked about there's a happy point of her life when her billboard was up. And, you know, and I'm just wondering if there was times and through reading through her journals that there was chunks of time that she had joy in her life, or did it kind of go back and forth?
I think it was brief, other than her ability to power through things and have a night, have fun, be the center of attention and throw parties for her friends in a room, you know, all through her life. It seems to me that it was only in that sort of short window, in a way, between 1969, when she got out of prison and quit drugs, to around 72, 73 after her heart failure, where she then got in a car accident and started having a lot of physical pain and then getting back on drugs. It was a pretty brief period where she might have enjoyed some actual happiness for extended periods of time, but I get the feeling it was pretty fleeting otherwise.
I think the joy that she found, though, in the journals is where we get to see her at work. I think that's where a lot of her joy was. And probably like most of us, she was probably more predisposed to write in the journal if something was bothering her as opposed to when she was really happy.
Is there, if you were able to kind of put her anywhere in history, where would she have done the best in terms of, if there's a place in terms of her music to place her where she would have had the most chance for success, you know, using any time you want, where would you put her?
I don't know. Maybe if she had started a little bit earlier and could have linked up with some of the groups that would have covered her songs, like Laura Nyro did with Fifth Dimension, and, you know, people, she kind of missed that opportunity to have some of her songs covered, which could have, you know, lofted her a little higher, perhaps. I don't know. It's really hard to say, though. Now, you know.
Right now, because I think that she would probably have been able to find an audience perhaps faster and easier. But maybe more importantly, I think she would have been able to avail herself to all the societal supports for, you know, people dealing with trauma that we have now that we didn't have then. And recovery is a whole different world now. You know?
Very true.
And just for a plug, if you want, I know this comes out on the 12th. That's Friday, correct? If I'm not mistaken. Is there anything else you want to plug in terms of the documentary? Anything you want to just put out there for people to where to check it out, how to check it out, if it's touring anywhere, you know, I know it's going to be on some theaters.
Please come and see it. It's going to be on Apple TV and Amazon beginning April 12th. And if you go to the Greenwich Entertainment website, you can see all the different screenings that are happening in different cities.
And Andy and Brian, thank you so much. This is just a beautiful, beautiful documentary. I'm glad it's added so much to my life. Right? I can't tell you how many people I recommended this outside of even getting ready for this interview. I'm just like, this, you have to see this. And I really, yeah, you really guys did something really beautiful. And I'm hoping this really does elevate more, get more people to really know about her, because she is phenomenal. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you, Emma.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Rich. Appreciate the words, the kind words.
Hey, thanks so much for checking out this episode. Again, highly recommend you can rent this documentary on Apple TV or on Amazon. It will blow your mind. It will make you a fan of Judy. There's a few of her records out on vinyl I highly recommend. Yeah, and just, you know, check us out on Instagram, Vintage Games Archive. Been doing that for about 13 years now, and then the podcast kind of came in the last 2 years. We're about to hit 100 episodes, so please spread the word as much as you can, because it's kind of hard to get the word out about independent podcasts, especially ones that are focused on kind of outsiders in the first place. But I gotta say, I'm very proud of the work we've been doing, and we're about to hit 100 episodes, and I couldn't be more excited. So enjoy. Thank you.